Hello, my name is Rahasia, and you're listening to The Spiritual Activist Show, and we're going to be talking to Bruce Lipton today, and I tell you, if you ever get confused about what to do in life, Bruce Lipton is the guy to talk to because he has a unique way of taking natural processes and overlaying them on our society, and it really makes things a lot clearer when you can see how nature has been taking care of itself for millions, if not billions of years. And apply this to how we need to restructure our society, because truth is, we live in a completely unsustainable society, and we're heading for a total collapse if we're not very, very careful. Everything is on the line right now. So I hope you enjoy this interview with Bruce Lipton. You're listening to the Spiritual Activist Radio Show, and today I'm talking with a dear friend for many years now, Dr. Bruce Lipton. And you can always find out more about Bruce at www.brucelipton.com. And to find out more about being a spiritual activist and supporting this show, which is a nonprofit, visit www.spiritualactivist.com. Now, let's see what Bruce has to say. Because him and I always hit the ground running, so hang on. So, thank you very much for doing this, Bruce. I know you've been so busy and traveling, and this is really nice.
We've been doing this for years now.
I'm telling you.
How long have we been doing it?
Oh, about
a long time.
Yeah, about 12 years. You were in one of our You were in one of our first issues. Yep, long time ago, Bruce.
Very happy to be there. Very happy to have been there and still be here.
Yeah, it's a blessing. If nothing else, just to see how this thing plays out. Because we're in the most interesting times, at least in this civilization's epoch, ever. Because now we're down to the wire. There is no more decisions on if we should do this. We have to do something. And it really does look like things are going to collapse, which is a good thing, you know, while we still have some resources. You know, we brought a guy here, Richard Heinberg. He wrote books like Peak Oil, Peak Everything. He's a financial expert.
Yeah.
We brought him to the university to give a lecture. Now, he's given this lecture about 2 hours to a bunch of young people, and it's pretty discouraging. You know, so at the end of the lecture, this young girl raises her hand. She goes, excuse me, what should we be taking here to prepare us? And Richard looked around sort of conspiratorial and said, well, I'm at a university, so I sort of hate to say this, but there's nothing here that's going to help you. You need to be close to water, learn how to grow food, build community, and wake up. Because the world you're planning on, it's phasing out. And she goes, oh, it was not the best news.
Well, you know, I've been talking to people a long time about this because I've been telling them that, you know, this evolution is necessary, but the reality is you cannot build a sustainable foundation on the existing structure. It won't work. The structure is corrupt. So the only way to evolve is to have a breakdown of the structure.
Right.
I've been talking about that, and I've been trying to tell people, this is good news. You look out, you're all afraid. It's all bad news what you see. And I say, worst news is that nothing happened, because worst news is we're already on this beeline toward extinction. And you know, when people think of extinction, they think, oh, like evolutionary stuff, oh, 100 years, a million years, you know, or something like that. And it's like, how about a few decades? We're talking some decades here, you know, that. And so the reality is it's up front. It's personal right now. And this is a required period. We need to do this. Otherwise, there will be no moving into the future. Simple as that. So I tell people, I said, well, we have to look at this as good news. This is totally good news, because if we're going to build something, we have to build from the bottom. You can't fix the system. System is gone. Start from the bottom.
Yep.
So I've been giving that message a lot, and it's wonderful how many people write back, because they say, in the ear of all this bad news, everything is bad news. It's like, wait, maybe it's not bad news. Stop. Let's look at it from a different perspective, because it's actually great news. We're going extinct so fast that we don't have a lot of time to play.
Yeah.
Between now and when it hits the wall.
Sometimes I hear people say, maybe we could fix the system. I go, oh my God, we don't want to fix the very system that put us in this position, you know? And
absolutely.
Sometimes I look at it like there's an analogy that I use. We built the original building on a foundation that was meant for 10 stories. But now we're up to about 180 stories, and we built this building that the only way it can continue to survive is to keep adding stories on it. It's our financial system. It has to eternally grow. Otherwise, it can't exist. So now it has to be brought down.
Yeah, and are we on recording now, or are we hanging out? Which one?
We're in,
hanging out or recording?
We're recording, but I can edit things out too.
Okay, well, because now what's important to say is to bring this up in regard to your last comment about a system where economics is always growing. This is a completely unsound biological reality that organisms, there are no organisms that continuously grow. They're organisms like us. We reach a certain size. And then after that, it's only replacement of what's lost every day. Every day we lose hundreds of billions of cells, and every day we create hundreds of billions of cells. The idea is there's two phases. There's a phase of growth, and then there's a phase of maintenance. Phase of maintenance is a flat line.
Right.
It says you should just keep it running now. The principle of forever grow, I use in a lecture, I show a rat that was genetically altered in a way that it just keeps eating, right? It gets so big that its little legs are extended out. It's on its stomach. It's so big that its legs can't really touch the ground because it's so big. And it's like, this is the image you're trying to create with an economic principle of continuous growth. It's completely anti-biological. It's completely, totally destructive to any organism that tries to carry this out. So there has to be a wake-up call. A wake-up call in that community of economics that says, wait a minute, your vision of perpetual sustained growth, there's nothing on planet Earth that has perpetual sustained growth
right.
like that. And therefore, it's an anomaly to biology. It doesn't work. So you got to reel it back and say, what would our future be? And I say, our future gets us up to the flat level of saying, here's where we are. And after that, the future is replacement. Just replacement technology.
Right.
And this is really critical. And in fact, I'm working with a friend of mine in Australia about a new book on the economy. And it's relevant to this is that, of course, you know, my work always focuses on the nature of biology and the fractal character and that the images are repetitive and all that. And I go, well, then, first of all, let's understand a very simple fact. That there is an economy in the biology. In the body, there's an economy. There's actually money. It's in a physical unit called ATP. It's a unit of energy that the cell can break down that and then use that energy for life functions. Okay? It's the equivalent of money. And I go, well, here's the interesting fact about ATP. Number one, there's no such thing as inflation. Meaning, if I go back in history, I go back 4 billion years and I say, there was a process, let's say a digestion process, taking food A and making it into food B. And I say, how many ATP did that cost? And I say, well, about 4 billion years ago, it cost about, let's say, 10 ATP. I say, okay, it's 4 billion years later. How much does it cost? I say, 10 ATP. Basically, a unit of energy is a constant.
Right.
And money... fiat money, paper money, is totally not a constant at anything. It changes so fast that you have to, those money traders watch every 10 minutes what the hell's going on and the value of the money changing up and down. So number one, our money is false. It doesn't represent energy. It represents a sliding scale, so it's irrelevant.
Right.
Okay, because today it's a dollar's worth a dollar, and there's no reason why tomorrow morning we could wake up and then they say, today your dollar's worth 15 cents. It's like, what do you mean? ATP is worth ATP. It's always worth ATP. So a real economy is based on a real unit. that never changes, okay? So that's a failure number one. Failure number two is this. In biology, there are three levels to the economy. Level one, first rule, there is no wealth in the system until every cell in the body has the basics of life, until every cell has protection, food, healthcare, whatever is going on in the body. You can't say to these cells, like some skin cells, you say, well, we have skin cells, they don't do that much, who needs them? I say, you can't say that. Every cell is needed in the system. So the rule is this, no individual can have wealth as long as there is an individual that doesn't have the basics. So the first level of any economy is everybody gets basics, food, shelter, healthcare, boom, and a job would be really good, okay? That's basic. Then I say what? Well, if we're very successful in our business efforts, our endeavors, our productivity, then we'll make an excess amount of energy from our activities. So I say, well, we got excess energy. Everybody got covered already, so what about this excess energy? I go, now cells can accumulate some ATP. As long as the ATP is available to every cell to get the basics, any extra ATP is now above basic, is called wealth. Okay, now, but here comes the interesting part. You can accumulate ATP in the cell, but it's physical. There's molecules. And I said, well, what's the issue? And I said, how many physical molecules can you store inside a cell? And the answer is not, enough for the cell's immediate life, maybe, but not for 10 lives. It can't store that much. So I say, well, wait a minute. Then an individual cell can only make so much, because beyond that, it's excessive and it doesn't help the individual cell anymore. Matter of fact, it might be a liability. And I say, oh, well, then what do you do with the extra money? Phase three. Extra proceeds beyond the wealth of the individual is wealth for the community. And it's stored as energy for the entire community. So if you break a leg, there's energy in the bank to fix a leg without anybody saying, well, what are you going to mean? Compromise my job as a liver cell because the leg is broken? I go, hey, the leg is broken. Liver cell's already in jeopardy anyway. So everything works together in community. So three levels of economics. A, everybody gets the basics first. If everybody's got the basics, guess what will happen? Reproduction will essentially almost stop. It will go to the normal. I said, what do you mean normal reproduction? Here's a biological fact. In normal biology, every two adults provide for two offspring. Basically saying that two adults provide for two offspring. So when two adults are gone, left are two offspring. The population didn't grow because they're going to have two offspring. And then when they go, then, it goes like that. So what's the point? In a normal biological system, a species only replaces itself, stays balanced. When we have a vision of the Darwinian Thomas Malthus principle is like, oh, animals will reproduce faster and faster and faster than the food supply will reproduce. And as a result, there's going to be a struggle for life. Hence, Darwinian theory, survival of the fittest, and the struggle for life is the belief that animal populations will grow excessively while food will have a limited amount of growth. And then that point is too many animals, not enough food, survival of the fittest, war, Darwin, blah, blah. Okay? This is not true. Malthus's idea was completely wrong, that he didn't understand the nature of two adults provide for two offspring. So a clam can lay 50,000 eggs, but 49,998 of those eggs are never going to make it to the adult stage. That's why 50,000 were let out.
Right.
So the point is only two. So the idea of Malthus's concept that animals reproduce excessively is not true. That everything would come to a natural balance. I say, yeah, but humans aren't reproducing two for two. I say, here's the story. You ready? This is the beautiful part, because we want to deal with population. And I say, well, how are we dealing with population? I say, well, conventional belief is birth control. Just give them some birth control. I go, you guys got it totally wrong. There's something called the biological imperative. The biological imperative is an understanding of the drives that organisms have, the drive for life, the drive for survival, That's built into every organism. If you try to kill a bacterium, it's not going to go, okay, kill me. A bacterium will do everything it can do to stay alive, even if you're trying to kill it. So there's a drive. So I say, biological imperative, drive to survive. There's two levels of the imperative. Two. Level number one, survival of the individual. Survival of me as an individual. Number two, survival of the species. I say, survival of me takes care of me. Survival of the species is reproduction. Okay. I say, so here's the point. When you're under threat as an individual, you'll do everything in your capacity to stay alive. That's just natural. You don't die because you all give up. You try. But then if there's a threat on this individual and more importantly, a threat on the species, then reproduction is enhanced. Why? Well, if we're going to be getting lost, we better make some more real quickly to see if we can keep it going. Okay. So here's the point. Survival of the individual. Let's say we'll take two countries, India, United States. And I don't even know if it's accurate data, but we'll just go like that. I say the difference between the two in regard to the individual is that in India, there's no Social Security. You get old, you don't have any food, you die. There's no place. Nobody's going to give you anything. The government's not going to support you. I say the U.S., we have Social Security. I reach a certain age, I'm still going to live because I will get return back from the government. So I say, what's the difference? I say, if you live in India and you have no Social Security, and let's say you're getting ripe old age like myself here, and you say, how much longer can I work to sustain myself because I'm getting so old I can't work, and then if I can't work, then I'm going to die. So I said, wait, but if I have a kid, then the kid could work, and the extra amount that the kid makes is Social Security for me. So my child will help support my life. I go, that's true. I say, but in India, it's so close to the edge that every individual just about makes exactly enough for their own life. There's not a lot left over for that. And I say, compensation. Not have one kid, have five kids. Why? If each one of you can give you a little tiny bit, five can give you a lot. So the idea is this. Where there's no Social Security, the biological imperative in our world of social world is to have more kids, because more kids will be Social Security. And so in India, you might have five or six kids in a family. Why? Because that's what the parents need to sustain themselves when they get old. I go, what about in the U.S.? I say, less than two kids. We have like 1.5 or something like that, 1.5 kids. It's even less than the normal two. I say, why less? And the answer is, I don't need kids to support me when I get old. I'm okay. Okay, so one way of dropping reproduction, it's not birth control. That's irrelevant. That just clouds the issue. The way of dropping reproduction is security. If I know I'm going to be secure, I don't need to raise five or six kids. Okay? And it's demonstrated in every Western country that has security. Yep. They don't have hundreds of kids. They got a few kids. Okay. So number one, if we would just provide economy level number one that we talked about, everybody gets the basics, then the biological imperative, the drive to survive, will be accommodated for the individual. Okay. But then now part two, if the species is under threat, then the species is going to reproduce faster and younger to keep itself alive. Well, we're under threat. Not psychological. It's below that. It's a physiological response. It says we as a species, we as every species on this planet is under threat because of the environmental upheaval. So we will have a tendency to reproduce faster, not consciously, not conscious. I'm not thinking about it. It's just sort of biological imperative. Something's wrong. I know it. I'm not going to have sex because I know it. That's just a circuitous connection that you'll have sex anyway. But underneath it is why are you reproducing more? And the answer is because there's a threat. So number one is our reproduction problem is the problem of a population growing ever greater and greater and greater. But the population grows greater because there's less security in the biological imperative of those that are alive seeking security by having more kids. That would stop if rule one of the economy, everybody gets the basics, is already included. That means why would I reproduce? Why? What the hell do I need to provide for all these kids until they get old enough? I don't need to do that. I'm okay.
Yeah, and it seems like this is actually playing out pretty well in places like the Netherlands. You know, they have pretty good security for old age, health insurance, and their population seems to be staying pretty stable, you know?
Yes. That's the destination. So when we look at it and everybody's talking about this population growing and growing, it's going to create a problem. I go, of course it's going to create a problem, but we're creating the problem to make that problem. Because there wouldn't be that population explosion if people were secure.
Right.
And since we live in a world that screw those millions of Africans that are dying of starvation at this minute while we're throwing away food into the street, is an understanding that says we are not a unified world of people, which is where the destination of our evolution is bound. That I don't care what country you come from, we are all cells in the body of a super organism called humanity. Now, humanity is in a state of formation. That's the civilization of people, where we're going to let go of the borders, the boundaries, and start to recognize, I don't care where you are, if you're a human on this planet, you're part of us. I mean, in California, very interestingly, we put so much effort into anti-pollution laws, and we dropped the level of pollution in cities like LA, you know, and because of our strict rules on pollution. And now there's a sharp spike in the rising of pollution. You know what? It's not coming from LA. It's coming from China. It's coming from India and China. And it basically says their air pollution is coming to us. Yeah. And so the point is this. That's, again, the wake-up call that says, if you're a human on this planet, you're connected to every other human no matter what way you want to look at it, be it economics or air, water, whatever it is. So the evolution is the breakdown of the barriers that separate people to recognize we're all in the same boat, baby. You know, to go to India and see people breathing air that you can see. It's like, oh, my God, this is like perpetual smog here because nobody's taking care of the situation. There's a point that it's a wake-up call.
Yeah, there's towns where it's so bad you can only see like 50 to 100 feet. You know, I remember I used to own a recycling center in San Diego. People would bring in all their wire, and it either has to be stripped or burned off. I found out that all of our wire was being shipped to China, and they just burned it off into the atmosphere. All of the plastic and all of the insulation, everything. Yeah. So, Bruce.
So, this is the issue.
So, Bruce.
Yes.
I was just thinking, like, getting into the Three Amigos, you know, I've been, actually, this is going to be our next issue. It's with Joe Dispenza, you know.
Yeah.
And I've been really getting into this, and it seems like the information that you, Joe Dispenza, Greg Braden, you're all coming at this from different angles, but this information, I really think that it's rewiring our brain. And as it's rewiring my brain, as I'm doing the meditations to sort of like cancel out some of the old programming, I'm actually starting to see a different world. And sometimes I wonder, is it just my perception or is the world actually changing around me? What do you think about that?
Well, first of all, it is our perception because it's the only way we can deal with the world is through our perception. And we have to change our perceptions because we've been programmed with misperceptions. And these misperceptions, by continuing this programming that's a more ancient, it was good in the beginning. We needed some programming to get us off the ground. But this continuous perception of a Darwinian world of it's me against you, survival of the fittest, screw everybody else, is so short-sighted and leading to the death of civilization with countries competing against each other. It's like you can't compete. It's like your stomach competing with your pancreas. You know, it's like, hey, screw the pancreas. You know, we need more cells and more stuff down here. The pancreas, who cares about it? It's like, what do you mean who cares about the pancreas? Pancreas, every organ is part of the system. So, you know, obviously say, well, hey, take a system. let's eliminate an organ system today. Okay, you pick one and just tell me which one you don't want. We're going to get rid of it. It's sort of like Trump. Hey, let's pick EPA. We don't want that one. It's like, okay, take your lungs, throw them out. We don't need the lungs. It's like, what? Point is this, is that this world, based on false perceptions of a Darwinian belief that life is based on a struggle, which is completely not, because life is derived from the Garden of Eden. It was a garden before we messed it up. A garden, by definition, is not a battleground. A garden, by definition, is total cooperation of every organism in the garden. And therefore, we came from a garden, have broken it up into battlegrounds, put borders and barriers between these structures, and try to live this way. It's like, no. The borders and things have to come down. So I guess here's the important part. We are in the process of evolution. We are in the process of breaking down the old structure because we can't survive. We're already facing the wall. It says you can't do this anymore. It says, well, then what are you going to do? It says you got to do something different now. Well, crisis provokes evolution because crisis says you hit the wall. Evolution means you got to do something different now. And I say, well, what's going to be different? I go, the difference is this, that the human population on the entire planet is every human is a cell in the forming structure of a new organism called humanity, which is a superorganism, that the nervous system of this humanity has been established. It's called the Internet. The Internet is what connects 7.5 billion cells into one thing, okay? But it also provided for a new generation. And the new generation, this millennial generation, I say, what's different? Millennial generation, previous generation, what's different? The answer is this. The millennial generation grew up with computers. The millennial generation sees no borders. When they talk to somebody on a computer, it could be from China, it could be from Russia, it could be from India. The computer, I can talk to anybody anywhere, anytime. So their world when they grew up was not the narrow world of their parents, which were restricted to who they knew in the neighborhood. That was what it's all about. The global community is called the millennials. Now, here's an issue, because the millennials are the ones that are going, oh, woe with me. I paid all this money for education and I can't get a job. And my parents have a 5-car garage. I'm sharing an apartment with 3 other people because none of us can afford it. And they're like, oh, what? We're left out. And I go, precisely. That is the most important step of evolution. The millennials are pushing the evolution for this reason. Simple fact, just simple. A government can only stand in regard to how many people support the government.
Yep. And
when you get less than 50.
And the millennials aren't invested in the old system. So in a sense, the old system is unknowingly maybe building into it a system of self-destruction.
It's in process right now because you go to a millennial and you say, hey, the stock market's going to crash. And they'll look at you and go, like, I own a stock? Well, I don't own a stock. I don't give a crap about the stock market. I go, yeah. Less than 50% of the people do. And the result is there's an entire generation that is, I think, at least 50% or more of the world's population at this moment, which is not connected to their structure. Everywhere, right. Arab Spring, young people, I'm not connected. Look, I look on a computer, I see people in Hollywood, and I look at the guy here in the desert in the sand. I go, what's this all about? They have no border. So Arab Spring was, I want what they have on the other side of the world.
Right.
Ah, so the point is this. The millennials are the key to this evolution. Interesting, at their moment of assembly at this point, they don't see who they are, or they don't see how powerful they really are. Because all they're invested in is I have nothing and I owe all this money for education and I can't get a job. Okay. And so I say, yep, they're not part of the system. And that is the most important part of the evolution. They're not part of the system.
Yeah, it almost seems like they also see the insanity of polarities. And in that sense, I just wrote an article called Walking on the Razor's Edge. And it's about maintaining balance, you know, looking at the left, looking at the right, but maintaining this other balance of consciousness And it's a precarious way to live. It's almost like, remember riding a bike? When you first start riding a bike, you do it with your left brain. Oh, I'm falling to the right. And you fall down back and forth. But then there's that magic moment when your body mind shifts in. And now all of a sudden you're riding the bike and you realize that only a few moments ago, what was inevitable, falling, has now become impossible. And I think that's going to happen to us as a collective consciousness if we can keep getting this information out there, because it's not exactly fake it till you make it, but in a way, you know, we're trying out this new way of thinking, and I see it changing.
Yes.
In different levels. Like, it used to be that scientists, you know, if you wanted to be a scientist and come up with a new idea, Pythagoras, you know, Copernicus, Newton, Einstein, they all stood on the shoulders of who came before. And in religion, the Jesus and the Buddha, they were like a new vision, and Jesus wasn't dependent on Buddha. But now I see something happening, with especially quantum physicists. This is merging. It's merging into something totally different, because I was listening to the radio the other day and this guy was talking. I think it was Brian Greene. And I thought I was listening to a preacher or a priest or some avatar. Then all of a sudden I realized, oh my God, he's a quantum physicist. So everything is changing right now. It's so interesting.
Yeah, but this is a civilization upheaval. This is a fact, and this is exciting, because if it doesn't undergo an upheaval, well, then enjoy the last remaining bits of life on this planet for us, because it's not sustainable. It's not going to work. Period. I mean. They took a survey of all the animals, the population of animals on this planet. In 1970, they took a survey. How many animals are in nature? Fish and animals. How many are out there? Come up with a number. They recently did this again. And here's the issue. 62% of that population has disappeared since 1970.
That's a lot.
There's only 38% of the animals, 2/3 of life has disappeared. Since 1970. It's like, wake up. This is what is called a mass extinction. Mass extinction.
Yeah.
The five times life was thriving, and then something, you know, catastrophic just, you know, broke it apart. The last one, the dinosaurs, apparently was a comet hit the planet and upended the environment and wiped out life, and that's the way it goes. Today, the data is we're losing species of organisms faster
right.
than in the previous five mass extinctions. And then the bigger problem is we now know that the cause of this mass extinction is human behavior. It's like, oh, Jesus, we're killing ourselves. It's like, yep. And the point about it is it's already clear. This is not like, you know, could be happening. It is happening. The 2048 is a date. Scientists have come to it. I think it's conservative that there will be no fish in the ocean.
Yeah.
In 2048. Like, that's like science fiction. Planet Earth, no fish in the ocean.
Yeah.
What?
I know. And,
like,
and if you tell somebody this, they'll say, oh no, our civilization will never go extinct. And you go, wait a minute. It always has. As we go back in the past, that's the reason we don't have any ancient civilizations. They're all in ruins and buried under 10, 15 feet of mud and slush, because they have been here also. And we need to learn our lesson and realize that if we don't, because I think we've created a civilization, Bruce, that is far too complex for our 3D monkey minds to figure out. We have to shift. If we don't shift into like Einstein said, we're never going to come up with the solutions to the same level that created the problems. It's totally right. If we don't shift into this other level of awareness, because that's where the answers are. We don't know the answer now. You and I could sit here and talk all day long, And every answer we would come up to would actually cause a little bit of a disturbance in some other area. The real answers lies beyond our everyday thinking right now.
Right, but this is the beautiful part. In physics, there's something called emergence. Emergence means this. You can study all these different pieces of something, but when they come together, when pieces come together, they can create something that you could never have imagined from studying any of the individual pieces. So, for example, I could study a resistor. I can study a transistor, a capacitor. I can study these parts. And I can know all about these parts. But I don't understand about the radio. The radio is when the parts all come together. Looking at all the individual parts, I don't see a radio in the parts. They have to come together. So emergence is new properties arise when individuals get together in a community. I'll give you an example. How many people did it take to create a computer? And the answer is over 50,000 individual discoveries were required to create a computer. I say, you can't have 50,000 discoveries with a population of 5,000 people. It's never going to happen.
Right.
But as the population gets bigger, the number of contributing factors is greater. And there's an emergence is what physics talks about. When you bring enough together, there'll be characteristics or developments that you could never anticipate or imagine in the previous state. The guy who created the capacitor could never have envisioned a radio, much less a computer, come from that capacitor.
Right.
It wasn't there. Knew everything about a capacitor, but didn't know anything. So what we're finding today is as the world comes together, the more people that come together with divergent points of views offers the greater opportunity for emergence. That is the definition. So in other words, you can look at a human cell and say, where's consciousness in there? I say, well, I can't really show you the kind of consciousness you're talking about. Why? Because it takes 50 trillion cells to make that. I can't show it to you in a single cell. It's the assembly of cells. So what we're seeing is an emergence. And I can give you an example because the United States was the precursor of planetary evolution. Before the United States, every country was like a culture dish. The cells in that, the people in that dish bred with each other. The French bred with the French. The Germans bred with the Germans. The English bred with the English. And they created some great traits individually. But the significance was they reached the limit of what they could do as individuals in that plate. There's something called hybrid vigor. And those that grow corn know this, that the corn that you eat is not purebred corn. It's hybrid corn. You take two different kinds of species, bring them together, and the hybrid is what you eat, okay? The hybrid is stronger than the pure. And this comes when people talk about dogs. The mutt is stronger than the purebred, okay? And that is because bringing the traits together is stronger than just breeding one trait. Because you breed one trait, you also breed weakness into that trait as well. So I say, okay, hybrid vigor. I say, United States, hybrid vigor. Why? The United States was not created by one country. United States, in its fullest glory, was created by residents of countries from all over the planet coming together to share their awareness of their own worldview in a collected combined population. So the United States is hybrid vigor in regard to civilization. Why? It didn't have the purities. It took all of the individuals, put them together, shake them together, and said, oh, look what you created when you brought it all together. I say, the model of the future of planetary evolution is the United States. When everybody in the world starts to recognize we're all part of one country, then we work together. And as we work together, emergence is going to create things that, as you just said before, you and I could sit here and have all this conversation and never see where the answer is because we're just two out of, you know, the billions that are necessary. And so we're moving into an area where the advances of evolution are so great that in regard to our technology, yesterday's technology may be outdated by this afternoon. That's how fast the changes are occurring.
Yep.
But the changes are not just in technology. The changes are in all aspects of life. So I'm saying, then the civilization that we're building into will have more potential than any previous civilization. And the fact is, and I wanted to bring this up because my friend Greg Braden, you know, the Three Amigos, he talks about a place in Turkey called Göbekli Tepe. I don't know if you've written about that in the magazine or not.
I've read about it, though.
Well, let me just say something. Our conventional wisdom, which is incorrect, most of it is the history of the world, is that civilization started like in the Babylonia, Tigris, Euphrates, the cradle of civilization. What, 5,000 BC was like the beginning of civilization? And it's like Göbekli Tepe was a massive civilization that disappeared 10,000 years ago. It's like, you were thinking civilization started 5,000 years ago? There was a vast civilization here 10,000 years ago. Most interesting, because it still hasn't been, is nobody understands what happened. Where are these people? What happened? And what's interesting is we talk about, oh, civilizations get covered up over erosion for millions of years. The dirt and everything covers it up, and then you have to dig down and find it. This city is buried. But you know what was interesting? It wasn't buried by erosion. It was buried by the population.
Yep.
They actually took dirt and rocks and everything and filled in the buildings.
Yeah.
Filled up the buildings.
And
made a,
and you know
a
what,
hill over the whole... Nobody could see.
Well, yeah. One of the things that makes that really interesting is, one, they can carbon date a lot of the things because it's been covered.
Yep.
But it makes you really wonder, because with all the circles, it looks like there's some kind of coded information there that they almost wanted to cover up, knowing that it would be covered for millennia, and the people that would uncover it might figure it out. There's some kind of information there that we need to decipher.
Well, clearly, I mean, the fact that the civilization existed before we even thought thought it evolved, the massive civilization existed and left. And interesting, in the carbon dating, the end of that civilization is linked to climate change. And then you look at it and go, why? Well, I say, well, look where Göbekli Tepe is now. It's in Turkey. I go, yeah, very arid, dry, nothing grows there and all that. And I say, yeah, there was a massive civilization there. What it meant was they had lush crops. They could grow and live there. Climate change. You can't grow anymore. Well, then you can't sustain a civilization here anymore because there's no food. And that's when it left at some point. We have to see that this is happening right now. We're facing this climate change.
Yep.
Not predictable what's going to happen. And especially, you know, I'm, you know, a Californian. Interesting. People say, because I'm out of the country a lot, where are you from? I go, the country of California. Because it's like, I don't want to say United States anymore. I just
come
the country of California. And they all know, because everyone knows California is not the regular piece of the United States. It's its own thing.
Yep.
And so I'm very proud of California in that regard. And, you know, all the advances we made and trying to keep the environment clean and safe and things that are much more advanced than anywhere else. Well, but the relevance about all this is that this structure is coming to an end. And California is going to be an important part of that because of a simple fact. 52% of the food in the United States comes from California. Now that we're in the sixth year of the drought, even though we had torrential rain this year, that rain and stuff is really good, except that the ground was so dry that the water mainly ran off. It didn't go down. It ran off. So it rained a lot, but it's not deep dirt. It's surface water.
Yeah, the water problem is the aquifers that are going dry that takes thousands of years to fill up. Like if we would stop sucking all the water out, wait a few hundred years, you know, we'd be in better shape. But the rainwater basically runs off or just soaks in or evaporates. We need like a lot of years of this kind of rain to really start filling up aquifers again.
Yeah, or the evolution of new technology, which is in our forefront with so many people around the globe working on the concept. There will be resolutions of this technology that we have to plan for the climate change, not go under the belief that if we stop doing something today, everything will come back. It's like, it's not coming back.
Yeah.
It's changed. And just as much as Göbekli Tepe had to bury itself under the fact that nobody could live there, Los Angeles isn't that far away from doing the same thing.
Yep.
There's no water. What are you going to do down there? You know, stuff like that. So we have lessons to learn from the previous ones. And we are in the process of this learning right now. And that, look, you and I, as part of the elders.
How did that happen?
The elders are people. We just got old. We were having a good time, then we got old. But the fact is this, we carry with us the thinking that was hatched in 1969 when a new civilization was seeded. Today's millennial generation came from the spawn
right.
of 1969. And that was when there was a global evolution that started, but you couldn't see it because the beginning of the evolution is not really apparent to most people, only when it reaches a critical stage. So because everything is fractal and everything has a repetitive pattern, look at human civilization as a multicellular organism. That's what it is. We are cells. Civilization is a multicellular organism. And I go, oh, well, then in the evolution of animals, because civilization is not a plant, it's an animal organism, there's a pattern. Fish, amphibians, reptiles, birds, mammals, a pattern of vertebrate evolution. And before that was invertebrate. And invertebrate means supported from the outside.
Mm-hmm.
Vertebrate is supported from the inside. I go, before technology, civilization was invertebrate. The support didn't come from anything that people were doing. The support came because the fruit was on the trees. You know, if there was food on the ground, we got some food. We only ate because it came from the outside. We didn't do anything. We just lived from the support from the outside. But once we started to use our intelligence, we started to create technology. And technology is what allowed us to then go into the vertebrate level, support from the inside, not waiting for the environment to help us, but from our intelligence, creating what we can do for the environment. So the first phase was called mariculture. That was the early phase where ships went from coast to coast to coast. I said, mariculture is the fish phase of human civilization. Why? Because we had to live where the water was. There was no way. You can't go inland if you don't have any water. You got to stay where the water is. So we thrived off the farming, the water, and the sea. Okay? But then technology evolved to take the water with us into land. Or find the water, or create the water, dig wells, aquifers, whatever, do these things. I say, that led to leaving the water and going on to land. I go, that's amphibians. Amphibians created agriculture based on what? The ability to not have the water restricted at the coast, but to take the water with them wherever they go so that they were no longer restricted to the water. They are now on land.
Right.
So amphibians, the agriculture came from mariculture. And I go, then what? And I say, the next generation of civilization grew up on the land, didn't grow up in the water like the tadpoles. They just grew up on the land. So they were developed for land versus the previous ones, which were water to land. So these were the small things called reptiles. Reptiles were created as animals of the land. Their technology of living on the land is far greater than any amphibians' technology because amphibians lived in two worlds. But reptiles, so I say, well, what did the reptiles start out as? I said, they started out as these little tiny lizards. And I said, then what happened to them? I said, then they became giant dinosaurs. I go, how'd that happen? And here's how it happened. The ability to live on land created behaviors. And I say, cool. I say, look, here's the hind leg of a lizard, 5-inch lizard. See, it does this movement. I go, great. And I say, here's the hind leg of a 50-foot dinosaur. It does the same thing. It just took the template of the 5-inch lizard and blew it up into 50 feet. I go, yeah, same thing. Only one problem. The physical body got bigger, but the brain didn't get bigger. The brain stayed small because why? It was just running the same reflexes that it did as a 5-inch lizard. Move the leg. That's all it has to do. I say, there's a problem. The body gets so massive that the intelligence of the system would have trouble maintaining it if the environment changes. Because if the environment changes, you have to have a lot of awareness to jump into the game to change the system. But so you look at it, you say, look, mom and pop shops were the beginning of corporations. They were small lizards that came together. But then they grew bigger and bigger. And then they made factories. Then they made big corporations. I go, yeah, these grew bigger and bigger. Their corporation's a dinosaur of a lizard. That's what it was. But the intelligence never got any better either. That's how General Motors can make a Humvee in the midst of an oil crisis. A Humvee gets 8 miles to the gallon at most. Is like, who the hell builds a car that gets 8 miles to the gallon when you can't get any gasoline? It's like, dinosaur right. builds that, you know? I said, but here's the interesting part. The reptilian civilization is run by, and euphemistically, it's called the blood of the dinosaur.
Yeah.
Oil. Okay, so our industrial civilization is reptilian. And reptiles, they eat their own young. Enron, big corporation, ate its own workers. You know, it's like, wow, that's reptilian.
Yeah.
But then from reptiles, we went fish, mariculture, amphibians, agriculture, reptiles, industrial civilization, birds. 1900, Wilbur and Orville Wright became the first birds. The evolution of the birds went to 1969 because the bird then landed on the moon. The bird phase of civilization, aviation.
The eagle has
1900,
landed.
1969. And I said, what happened? They took a picture of the Earth on the moon's horizon and sent that back home. Birds have perspective. You see, that's what animals don't have. Birds are up here. Right. They look down, see what's going on. So the perspective of the aviation world, the bird world, of landing on the moon led to a picture of the Earth. And you were back there and I was back there. And what happened when that picture showed up? Everybody went, oh my God, that's all there is? It's this beautiful little blue-green thing in the middle of all that blackness? That's all there is. And all of a sudden, we hippies came up with the idea of, well, we better take care of this place. We better take care of the water, and we better take care of the air, and take care of each other, and take care, and take care. And I go, take care, isn't that called nurturing? I go, yeah. I say, ah, the reptiles led to the birds, landed on the moon, took a picture of the Earth. The picture precipitated a new belief system called nurturing, which were mammals. The first mammals were the hippies.
Right.
I go, yeah, but here's the problem. The first mammals were created when the dinosaurs were here. And when the dinosaurs were here, the mammals were called the meek. They had no power. They had nothing. The dinosaurs squish them. They didn't care, you know. But guess what? The dinosaurs die. Why? First of all, they're running out of blood. The blood that keeps this thing running isn't working anymore. We're running out of blood. That's a coming end of a reptile. I go, what happens when the reptiles crash? I say, the meek take over the Earth. I say, who are the meek? Well, we were the mammals in 1969, the few of us, the little furry guys. But today, we have the millennial generation, which is a derivative of the mammal generation. And they now reach a size and a power that at the edge of the corporations beginning to fall. Why? Reptiles. They couldn't run the whole thing. They couldn't accommodate the change. We're in the middle of change. They can't accommodate the change. Only the mammals can do this. And all of a sudden I said, what does that mean? I said, nurturing comes back in as the primary thing. Not the industrial raping of the planet, but nurturing. And so we are now breeding a generation of people who see no borders, who don't have race bias as much as their parents, don't have religious bias as much as the parents, see a connectivity of everything, a wholeness, and the idea is their lives are threatened, and they know they have to take care of themselves.
So
what we're seeing is the evolution, the birth, the manifestation of mammals as the dominant class and the loss of the big reptiles, the big corporations, as the collapsing previous phase of civilization, reptiles. So we're at in the history where the dinosaurs were falling and the meek were rising. And here we are today. And some of us meek were the ones that were here in 1969.
Right.
That still remember this call for nurturing.
And you
that
you
are
know,
doing
I,
it now.
I can see that that generation in 1969 where everything was clear. Hell no, I won't go. You know, when we found out what it was about, I can see that energy awakening in my kids, who's approaching 50 years old right now. They sort of lost it for years, yeah. But now they're starting to wake up to it. And my grandkid, he's totally a millennial kid, and he's like deeply embedded in it. So I have me from this side reminding them of their past, and the great grand or the grandkid looking at the parent and reminding them of the future. So it's we're like all working together to bring in something totally different. Hey, Bruce, one thing I wanted to ask you about before we get run out of time or something is vaccinations. What do you think?
Yes.
What do you think is behind that? Because obviously we can't keep doing this. Otherwise, it's going to take the total population to take care of autistic kids. And that's not where we want to go. What do you think is behind
it? So if you'd like to hear the rest of this interview and hear what Bruce Lipton has to say about vaccinations, I really advise you to listen to it. And you can listen to this entire interview at www.spiritualactivist.com. And you can also watch it and listen to it on our Lotus Guide YouTube channel, which is youtube.com/Lotus Guide. Thank you very much for listening and stay in tune. Thank you.